pomegranates, quince, and of course, lots of olive trees. Mazin and Jesse also raise animals of various sorts. There's also a really green pond, a water feature with frogs in it, and I'm looking at one of those frogs swimming along as and boy, are those guys jumping. There must be a few girls in there. And a hydroponic shed where various plants are being grown through drip irrigation. And tilapia are raised in a set of tanks, which are constantly sending nutrient-rich water through a set of pipes to plants, other plants growing here, tomatoes and broccoli and cauliflower. Last night, Jesse and Mazin and I prepared a bed, weeded it, and removed the snake cucumber, an eddy of Palestinian cucumber, renowned in the village of Beit Sahur, just a little bit east of, heavily soaked with water. And there's even a composting toilet here. Down and relax for just a half an hour and enjoy the view. It's a very, very pleasant little spot, I must confess. Though I haven't used dozens of species of plants, many of them flowering, most notably about a dozen species of orchid, rows and rosemary, and various sheds where plants are growing with plastic bottles serving as siding and also insulation. And a garden constructed out of 2.5-liter bottles. You pour water in the top and water just drips down. And there's the chicken. Hey guys, there's a whole bunch of chickens here, one of which is sitting on its eggs, and there's a couple of magnificent roosters and a bunch of rabbits. They've had their breakfast and they're waiting for their afternoon snack. Amongst the most intriguing creatures here at the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability and the Palestine Museum of Natural History. There is a Museum of Natural History here with a library and a lab. Kids can read, enjoy, study from, is this enclosure with a couple of Palestinians. The first time you see these guys, they're actually a pair of girls. You think they're kind of unseemly, not very attractive, but the more you get to know them, the cuter they become, and they kind of bleat like sheep. So I've just spent a week here, and I've got another week to go. I'm volunteering. I spent half a day driving down to Batir, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, with Mazin and a friend. And today I sat down with Mazin Coupsier and spoke with him about his center, now celebrating its 10th anniversary here in Bethlehem on the Mar Andrea campus of the University of Bethlehem. Okay. Introduce yourself. Tell me who you are.
Well, I'm a troublemaker born in that village over there called Beit Sahur. The good troublemaking. As a Palestinian born in this country, you are always under pressure. So from my childhood, I realized we have problems here and we have challenges and we have to face these challenges. We have to rise up to these challenges. We have to resist these oppressions, etc. And of course, you know, what our parents teach us, like kindness, generosity, help to others. My mother, for example, who was born also here in the Bethlehem area and raised here, spent her 90-some years here, rarely ventured outside the country. I managed to bring her to the U.S. in 1985 was born, but that was the only time she ventured in such a country or outside the country. So anyway, was raised. She to take me with her as a child to visit refugees. At the time, they were not living in either tents or things or anything. They were living in caves and in the open, basically. And so she was food and clothes, used clothes from us. So I learned from her that we should care for each other, that we should for the people. My family is not refugees. My grandmother on my mother's side is from Nazareth. I am a displaced person because refugees technically are ones who live outside the country. This is what this. I was raised here. I was educated here. I went to graduate school in the U.S. and I came back here. After working in the U.S. for a few years at universities like Duke and Yale University and others, becoming a well-known researcher and laboratory director there, I gave up all that good life, went from a six-figure income to a zero-figure income by coming back to Palestine. And that was the best decision I made in my life in 2008. So I've been here back to Palestine 16 years now. Started, to do projects here, including this institute, which we can talk about.
Tell me about the institute. Where are we? What is this place?
So, here I'm sitting in the fresh air, smelling the nice flowers and, it's an oasis in the middle of Bethlehem. The Zionist colonizers took most of our land. Of course, essentially 97% of the land became the State of Israel as Palestinian land was taken over. That's within the Green Line. Then Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza and Heights. So they came here in Bethlehem in 1967. This is Bethlehem where Jesus was born. Bethlehem district goes from here all the way to the Dead Sea over there, which on a clear day you can actually see the mountains of Jordan there. And if you go up the roof of this building, you can actually see the Dead Sea. It's not very far, so it's a small area. Anyway, the Bethlehem district, center it, was taken for Israeli Jewish-only settlements or colonies. So we're restricted to 15% of the land. And this 15% of the land, you could even videotape later, show how, because people are squeezed, they start to build vertically. So we have buildings going up all around. This remains the only open area, basically, within the city of Bethlehem, with some 400 species of introduced here in the Botanic Garden. We have a Museum of Natural History. We're building behind me, renovating and holding, making a larger museum. This is this institute. Why did we start it? As I said, to be like an oasis. Beyond that, it is a regional and even global hub for biodiversity and sustainability.
In Palestine?
No, global hub throughout the world and regional hub. What does that mean? Why the words biodiversity and sustainability in the name of the institute, Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability? The idea is that we want sustainability, and because this, you cannot have, of course, sustainability of nature without sustaining the humans that are living in that people. Vice versa, you cannot sustain indigenous native people, living next to a protected area, for example, without protecting that area, because we humans depend on nature.
We depend on the resources that the land provides.
The land provides, the plants provide us oxygen, they provide us with food, medicinal plants. Our ancestors never had modern medicine. They depended on plants for medicine. They depended on these resources that we have.
and water. I mean, all this vegetation, this biological diversity.
Right, absolutely. So this is why it's important and why this institute is important. And how does it go about doing this? So it's vision, if you want, it's sustainable human and natural communities. But how does it go about doing this? That's its mission and goals. We do this in brief time. I mean, research, education, conservation, and community service. These are the four categories of work that we do. And research on everything from human environmental impacts to, to colonial activities that destroy the environment, to protect the environment, to pedagogy, education. How do I educate children, for example, about climate change? What species are endangered, what is not endangered? How do I put them, whether I protect them, what's called in situ, in the location that they are present in, or ex situ, outside the location present. For example, we have orchids and irises here that we took from the wild and brought them here to grow them and propagate them and repopulate the wild with the species from here. This is the idea of conservation. We have an animal rehabilitation unit that's also conservation efforts. We do national strategies, local strategies, and also even global strategies. Some of our members, including me, are experts in conservation, so we are with the International Union of Conservation of Nature, or the Convention on Biological Diversity. We are engaged in various aspects of supporting global efforts to combat climate change and other threats to our environment. And finally, in community service, as I said, we have to protect the community. We have to make sure that our community has sustainable living. So we show them how to, sometimes it's a matter of even revive knowledge of how to grow things organically, not use pesticides, insecticides that damage the environment. So this is what we do in terms of community service. We help, for example, permaculture, aquaponics, aquaculture, information farmers, advice to farmers, sometimes direct help to farmers, like providing them with seeds and seedlings of native and indigenous plants. Yesterday, you and I, for example, some seeds of a local kind of a snake cucumber, they call it, Fakus, and an important baguette, and grow our own food. That's what we call food sovereignty. European Union and others, they like food security as a word. I don't like that, food security, because food security can come also from humanitarian aid, and I don't want that. I want food sovereignty. I want to be sovereign on my food production. As an indigenous person, as a native people, we have to be able to produce our own food, which is what our ancestors did for thousands of years. This is, after all, part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first developed agriculture.
And conversely, if I may jump in, one of the the occupation of Israel's occupation and of any colonizing entity or colonizing force, indigenous people, it's not simply driving people from their lands. There will always be people, indigenous people on the land, but the idea is to alienate them from the land.
Right, to make them disconnected from the land and from their heritage even. It's sort of like the European colonizers in North America insisted that they called mistakenly American Indians or Indians to give them Christian names. They don't wear traditional clothes, that they don't use traditional methods of hunting and fishing, growing things like that, that they become basically dependent on them or put in reservations where they can even starve, we don't care, can die by disease that we bring, like the, blankets that are infested and things like that. This is typical colonial attitude towards people.
And how has that played out in Palestine since 1967?
No. I mean, we write research about this a lot, and how the colonization impacted the local people and how it affected their lives and livelihood. But basically, today there are 15 million Palestinians, 8 million of us are refugees or displaced people, and that's not counting the 1.5 million people in Gaza that were displaced in the last 6 months, their homes demolished basically. Many of them, this is second time they become refugees or displaced people and move to Rafah area. And this is just an example. There are thousands of other examples of how they take over the land, the water, the springs, the production. Jaffa used to be a big export. Who fields of oranges belong to? Palestinians. They were all kicked out. Israel took this means of production, and they even took the label Jaffa oranges to mark, and they stole that and export now and use that as Jaffa oranges as being Israeli when they really are stolen Palestinian orchard of oranges.
Where are we going, man?
We're heading to get to a marginalized village called Battir. Battir and the area around it is a World Heritage Site and a very important site in Palestine. Landscape is beautiful. We had done some studies in the area of the valleys around Battir. This is in the South Jerusalem Hills. Now, as we depart Bethlehem, we go through Beit Jala. This is now actually technically is in Beit Jala. We are now in Beit Jala. And there are three refugee camps in Bethlehem. Total population of refugees in Bethlehem is about 1,000 people. About 60% of them live in the refugee camps. 40 refugees live outside the camps among the local people. Total population of the Bethlehem district is 250,000 people. That includes the refugees, of course. That's Palestinians, but there is also around 200,000 colonial settlers district of Bethlehem, and they control 85% of the land of the Bethlehem area. These like Tekoa and Har Homa and Har Gilo, which I'll show you in a minute. So there are three refugee camps within Bethlehem city itself. There are three cities or towns. Bethlehem is the largest, with 50,000-60,000 people. And then there's Beit Jala, which is this town. Beit Jala is around 12,000-13,000. And Beit Sahur, which is my village, with a similar number of people. Oh, shit. I hate stopping like this because I cannot start.
Well done!
I, you know, it's a manual shift.
It's like you always learn on a stick shift car how to start on a hill.
On a hill, and this, you know, they stopped in the worst possible place. And then a car behind me, so I cannot make any mistakes.
Bethlehem, we've got this whole region of the southern West Bank. Bethlehem, Beit Sahur, Beit Jala, Al-Walaja are all created from Jerusalem and from these incredibly biologically diverse lands between here and Jerusalem by this ring of settlements, Har Hil, our Gilo. Tell me about that. What impact the settlement ring around southern Jerusalem has had on native biological diversity and how you're trying to restore.
Well, I mean, Bethlehem as a district, we wrote a paper about how biodiversity was decimated in the Bethlehem district efforts thanks to settlements like this one that was built where there used to be a forested mountain here. And, you know, how the wall impacts biodiversity, the wall isolates Palestinians from their land, how the extraction of water from underneath our feet, the Israeli extraction of water from springs that used to be flowing springs, that of course creates an ecosystem, was an ecosystem for wetlands, wildlife like frogs and dragonflies and plants of, around water, etc. Birds, you know, migrating birds even. When they didn't want that flowing water, so they extract the water neck, you know, from inside the spring, so the water is not flowing anymore. That devastated the environment. The reason they did it, of course, the environment, but that was not the real reason. The real reason is they don't want flowing water that the Palestinians can use. So that's the reason why the European colonizers in North America killed 2 million buffaloes, for example, to deprive natives of the of this resource. So depriving indigenous native people from these kinds of resources is logical and expected in the context of colonization.
And yesterday we traveled on our way to Batir. We traveled through this valley, which I have seen on multiple occasions while taking the bus from Jerusalem to
Hebron.
Yeah, to Hebron, and you go through the Gilo Tunnel. You see on the right valley is very. You were talking about this as one of the last remaining biologically diverse intact systems. And
yeah,
so.
Now it's isolated and through. Sometimes we can't. Some roads are blocked, etc. And now they are expanding their settlements and they will destroy this valley. Al-Makhrur Valley is called. It's one of the several valleys in the South Jerusalem hills that are very critical for biodiversity, but they are very critical biocultural landscape. What do we mean by biocultural landscape? Is these are valleys and hills that have been used by humans for thousands of years. And so the terraces, for example, in those valleys that you saw, are some of them are thousands of years old. The stone terrace along the people grew olive trees. Olive trees were domesticated first in our region, the Eastern Mediterranean region, which is Turkey. This is where the original wild olive tree was domesticated about 5,000 years ago. And so starting these terraces to help reclaim the land and rehabilitate land to be able to use as agricultural fields. And this is why what was successful and sustained the human population here continuously, like Batir is continuously inhabited. There's never been of Batir. Other villages, there was ethnic cleansing, but not historically, only under the Zionist project. Villages like Lifta, Deir Yassin, Malha, those villages in West Jerusalem were all wiped out, kicked out. So their way of life that survived for thousands of years was decimated in a blink of an eye, basically in 1948. This is why it's important, and when you say it's an area beautiful valley, yes, there's beautiful valleys there, biocultural landscape. We actually managed to get it on the UNESCO World Heritage Site as an important World Heritage Site between Batir, Hussein, and Beit Jala, three towns there. The two valleys around them are a World Heritage Site.
But Israel is seizing some of that land.
Israel is not only seizing it, it's destroying it into a mini European landscape with the European settlement, colonial settlement, things that are even like they have in Europe, what do you call them, the red roof, sloped roof.
And they're calling some of these air troll concerts.
No, this particular area, they claim it as a national park.
Yeah, right.
National in the lands of Israel. National means Jewish nation, because Israel is a Jewish state, is a Jewish nation. Christian, Muslim, Baha'i, Druze are not considered human beings worthy of anything. They're not considered real. Part of the nation, that is the nation of Israel, that's the land of Israel. So when they say national park, it means it's a land for the Jews. That means they will protect it for its natural design or outlook, right? Because they don't want that. As I said, they want to create a European mental picture of what Europe, Eastern Europe looks like. They want to impose it here. This is the gate that locks Bethlehem. This is an Israeli military post. Whenever they feel like to, they can lock us in our ghetto or our concentration camp or our people warehouse.
It's a very roundabout way to get to Batir from Bethlehem. If one could go straight, it would be a lot quicker, but you're taking roads, aren't you?
No, but here is not difficult to get to when the gate is open, when they let us see you through this valley, because it's a natural area and I want to show you nature and I want to pick up bits on the way if I have a chance.
And there's the wall.
This from here you see the concept of maximum geography. Minimum demography. You can see they put only road here and the wall there that separates the people of that town, that village, Al-Khadr, their land, but there are Israeli